Hey, listeners, on behalf of Vox Vignette here in Austin, thank you for downloading the podcast and being a part of our community, whether it be literally or indirectly. We also want to provide you with the opportunity to join in our mission. We are passionate about the work God has called us to, and the reality is there's a financial cost to that mission. In our first 4 years, we've been active, leading a church, starting and running Space 12, and managing two homes for intentional community. We are excited for what God has called us to, and want to invite you to partner with us. If you're interested and want more information, please go to voxaustin.com, where you'll find more about what's going on and how to get involved. If you'd like to partner with us financially, click on the giving link on the right side of the front page. Again, thanks for being a part of our extended community. We hope that the podcast has been a blessing, or at least a suitable sedative to you and your ears.
We've been going through the book of Matthew, chapter 5, for the fall and also during the spring, just looking at the Sermon on the Mount. And last week, Paul Kim just helped us through the topic of anger and talked about anger. And this morning, I woke up really angry, and I just didn't know why, but I did know why. It's kind of not a great reason to be angry. But last week, I was introduced to Angry Birds. I know that I'm pretty late on the ball game with Angry Birds, but this is my first time last week playing Angry Birds, where it's just kind of this, I don't know, apple game where you just like throw birds around trying to kill pigs, right? And so I'm just playing, and just really frustrated with it. And then last night I had this vivid dream of these pigs just laughing at me the whole time. I'm just seeing all these pigs laughing at me, and then I just got really angry this morning. So to talk about anger, I think, Paul, I have to look at your, listen to your sermon again. I think there's some deep issues that I need to deal with in here. But we've been going through the series called A Pursuit of Happiness. And we started in the fall looking at the Beatitudes and just kind of Jesus's kind of look at what it means to be happy. When Jesus says, blessed are the poor, blessed are those who are meek, the word blessed literally means happy. And I think he's really wanting us to kind of set a new world order of what it means to us to live a life that's abundant, live a life that's kind of connected with each other, connected with the world, connected with him. And but, you know, with that, starting in February, we started to look at kind of the second half of it. And instead of just kind of these big ideas, he gets into the nitty-gritty. He talks about anger. He talks about the law and what that means. And today, we're going to be like two very tough issues that you know we all deal with and we're just exposed to. And what I love about it is that Jesus goes into the nitty-gritty and he talks about things that really matter to us and really impact us. And he does want us to live a life that's fruitful, live a life that's just connected with people. But he brings up anger first, and then now he brings up infidelity, divorce. And so sex and violence, just things that just tear us apart, tear relationships apart. These are things that Jesus just gets right into. And so I was thinking about blessedness, about happiness. And when I think about divorce, and when I think about infidelity and lust and all that stuff, it's really hard to see, you know, something that's beautiful or happy that comes out of that. If we were to kind of lay it all out, I think everyone in here, no one in this room has, everyone in this room has either personally experienced or knows people, family members or friends, that have their lives hurt by divorce, by affairs, by, you know, just being objectified and pornography, sexual abuse. And this is heavy, heavy stuff. And today we're going to try to jump right into it. And, you know, it just takes one little act of that, and it just has ripple effects and just cycles effects through families and generations, and how this has penetrated into our lives and our relationships, how we relate with each other, and how it affects our community as well. So I'm hopeful because Jesus does speak into it. And today we're going to look into that a little bit. You know, just personally, I have close friends and, you know, family members that have gone through that. And it's just such a hard thing. But with that, I feel like there's hope. And hopefully today we'll be able to talk a little bit about that. And we won't be able to cover everything, but just, in the midst of it, hopefully be able to find steps that we could take into just kind of redeeming that. It's not the greatest way to introduce. We have a guest speaker today, but... we have a friend here. She's our guest speaker today, and she's a friend, and also she's also a counselor here in Austin. And we thought that maybe in this topic, it would be great to be able to hear from her and just kind of hear a little bit more about these issues. So let me introduce Sarah Bingaman, if you can make your way up. Give her a hand. Yeah, you can just put it, and then... There's a mic over there for you. Sarah, maybe if you can introduce yourself, kind of your family, and then maybe what you do, and kind of how you got into counseling.
Yeah. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for letting me be a part of your community. I am married. My husband wanted to come with me, and our three-year-old is... Our three-year-old is sick, and so couldn't be here. But we have a three-year-old son named Samuel and an 11-month-old daughter named Ruth. And my husband's name is Joshua. So we are trying to cover the whole Old Testament here just within our own little unit. Joshua is a local business owner, so he's very busy with all that kind of that sort of world, and my world is counseling. And but the way I got there was definitely through marriage. I'm sorry I have my back to y'all. I feel kind of sad about that. I'll kind of go like this every now and then. When Joshua and I were dating, when you're dating, everything's pretty wonderful and magical and has the rainbow around the whole thing. And it was very much that way for us. But we kind of knew, we talked about difficult things, and we sort of knew there could be some stuff there that would potentially, we would have to face it. And so we went to counseling pretty soon after we got engaged, and sort of viewed it as, we're doing premarital counseling. And I do that because I sort of thought that would be a really surface way to sort of say, these are our likes and dislikes, and sort of check that off the list and say, okay, we're good, we're ready for marriage. And Joshua picked the counselor based on some referral and people that he knew that had gone to this man. And so we went, and it was not surface level, okay? I got in there and thought, whoa, this is way more than I intended to go, way deeper than I intended to go. And I, at the same time, I loved it. And it began our journey in a way that I would have never expected. I had every intention of going into a marriage just still having a little bit of guardedness about myself and thinking there will be things that just don't necessarily ever have to be shared, so I'm sure I can divide my heart in a certain way. And I'm so glad that that was challenged from the get-go, because that would have not been a good way to live. And so it deepened our relationship, and it gave me a love for counseling. And I loved that, especially a Christian counselor. My thinking had always been, they're just going to pray for you, and then you leave, and nothing has changed. And this was such a deep work in my life that I thought, I would love to do this for people. I would love to fight for them, to bring clarity in ways that, when you're living it, it's so confusing, and it's so hard to make sense of all that. So I get to do that now, every day. Now that I'm a mom, I work part-time most of the time, so I work 3 afternoons a week, and as a part of my internship, found this place called the Center for Relational Care, and I've been there ever since. I've been there for 5 years, and I work with individuals and with couples, and I see premarital couples. And I help with a lot of other hodgepodge things.
Well, we'll get back to your the place you work at, but I just want to set it up. I didn't just go on Google and found like Austin counselor, and this Sarah just popped up. We've actually had this growing relationship that we've kind of built just through various different ways. And one is just, you know, for us as a young church, you know, we're just trying to grow as a community. And as we grew as a community the last few years, we just really want to like share life together. And really want to not build a program, but just really want to build a really, you know, real, authentic community and just share life together. But we found out doing that is really hard. And when you really get to know people, and you get down to the nitty-gritties and stuff. And if you look around, you know, predominantly our average age here is probably around 28. And so we have just a lot of people, newlywed, probably the first 5 years in the marriage. We have, people just having kids. And we just have, you know, people that are pursuing relationships as well and just trying to figure out their careers. And it's just this time, stage in the life where we're just really trying to figure out these stuff and to kind of newly enter into this stuff. And maybe it's the first chance for us, a lot of us, to expose to, like, issues of divorce and separation and all that. So, you know, that was something that we really wanted to try to connect with. At the same time, for those that were here last year, we kind of started this campaign of this just really finding out, like, how does Vox, do we care for a community? And kind of the responses that we got is like, it's a very caring community. We whenever there's things that come up, there's a need, we try to meet it. But at the same time, there was also a sentiment that maybe that care needs to go deeper. And then it's kind of a fine line to go into, because we're such a small community, trying to figure out, well, how do we care for the individual? How do we, like, respect kind of their boundaries and their personal life? At the same time, how do we bring people into the community? And then I'll just also segue as, you know, as staff and people that have gone to seminary training, like, we've maybe taken, like, maybe one, two courses on counseling. And then there's just this idea, even for staff, as pastors, we're trying to figure out, well, what are the boundaries? How do we bring people to care together? But at the same time, knowing the boundaries, like, what is just so much that we need to kind of refer. So along with all that, we got to meet, you know, you. We got to meet your husband, Josh, and just through relationships, through the community. And kind of this is kind of where we're at. And we found out through Mosaic that you've been working with them. And then found out a little bit more about the place you work at. And maybe if you could share a little bit about the mission of Center for Relational Care.
Yeah, you know, My dad is a pastor and was a pastor my whole life, and Joshua's parents were in ministry, full-time ministry, and so we definitely saw what you're talking about, just the how overextended the ministry, the staff can get, and so I think that's one of the things that drew me to CRC. That's what we call it for short, because it's really long, if I have to keep saying that. For CRC, was that they really see themselves as an extension of the church community, and that they are there to sort of absorb what the church doesn't really have the ability at times, you know, to sit down with each person and to really get to the deeper issues, the heart issues. So, so our part, our desire is to just come alongside the church and also to train and equip the church to be able to do that. For their own community. And my director often says, we're trying to work ourselves out of a job, that we can train the church to actually be able to do some of this more often and to not be so afraid of what that means, what counseling means, what caregiving means.
And I just love just kind of even the name of your Center for Relational Care. I think especially in our culture and today, like, just relational care is just something that is just not talked about a lot, and it's just something that just really becomes a fabric of how communities kind of get tighter and closer. Well, we're gonna jump right in, if you're okay with that. And we're really thankful that you're here. We're going through Matthew, you know, the Sermon on the Mount, and Matthew 5. We're starting with verse 27, and I'm just gonna read it, and we're just gonna jump right in and just really get into this. Verse 27 says this. It's kind of on the screen. It says, you have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So, you know, right off the bat, you know, there's the Ten Commandments. You know, you have heard it was said. Jesus kind of talks about, like, you know, we're not commit adultery. The religious leaders at the time probably said, this is probably one of the easier ones to kind of master because, you know, there's a very like, clear line. It's like, well, it's just what adultery is. In fact, religious leaders back in the day, they took it the next step further and just said, well, we're just not going to associate with women at all and not even look at them. They have to look down. And so they just did anything they can to say, well, this is something that's easy for us. But it's really not that easy. What are some, like, first impressions or, like, a word that pops up when you see this verse?
Well, I it's not up here, but I guess the part I go to is the difference between the rule, the boundary that's set before us, and how this has often been used in such a shaming, condemning kind of way that we might look at that and think, I'm a human being, so I don't understand sort of what that means for me literally. So the confusion there.
Confusion.
Yeah.
Yeah, and my word for this is probably, like, almost feels a little helplessness in it because it feels like there's no win in this.
Yeah.
And I feel like when I've read this throughout my life, it's always with that guilt and shame. And I've been told this, and I thought it was pretty interesting, but I want to show you a graph, just kind of historically looking at just kind of relationships, marriage, and everything. So Matt, if you could go to this graph. And this is just kind of a simple graph by age, age 12, 18, 24, 30. And kind of in pre-modern society, puberty probably started around ages 13, 14. Some cultures even like 15 that it started. And that was just kind of the onset of adolescence and a kind of toward adulthood. And usually in pre-modern society, adulthood is kind of signified when you're just kind of, you're finally matured physically. And so actually it's probably around 17 that they're considered an adult. An interesting fact is financial independence is usually at the same time you become an adult, you're kind of sent away to become your own family. And marriage is usually around the same time. So if you see just kind of pre-modern society, like everything is clustered around a very short time frame. So that my grandparents were actually had an arranged marriage, and they were married when they were like 12, 13. And so, but it's interesting that you see like kind of more ancient societies that is there's no like that age range is so small that it kind of in your marriage you're discovering each other sexually, you're discovering courtship together. So it's all that. And so if you move on kind of historically, kind of we move to the 1900s all the way to about probably in the 1960s, puberty has gone younger. So usually around age 12, if you read your textbooks back in the day, it's usually 12 that starts. Adulthood is pretty defined, maybe around 18. Financial independence is probably around 21. And a marriage average age is around 24. So you see like the age range between when you become, you know, sexually, you start thinking about things like that, and you think about relationships, like there's like maybe 12 years of just kind of discovering that. And now, you look at the 2000s, okay, puberty, some statistics have seen is more younger and younger, some as early as 8 years old, 7 years old, you know, the kids are starting to get into puberty just through culture, you know, culture, environment, hormones, and everything. Adulthood is still 18. Financial independence, how many still live with their parents, has now it's like maybe like 25, 26, so college and all that doesn't mean you're financially independent. And then marriage is getting more and more closer to the 30 age range. Okay? So if you look at that, I mean, between, look, that's how long you have to wait, you know? True love waits. I mean, you have to wait a really, really long time. And And the whole idea of dating even is a kind of a new thing, right? I'll give you another statistic before I let you comment on this. The average age for men to be married in the U.S., this is about, this statistic is around 2007. Average age for men is 27.5, and for women is 25.6. This is for the U.S. For Sweden, the average age for men to get married is, can you guess? 35.1, and for women, 32.5. And in China, as kind of a new economic empire, men is still 33.8, and women 29.1. So you have this, like, and I don't want to say that, you know, there's, we could just blame culture, but we have this, like, it's not even, you could call teenage angst anymore. it's like, how do we deal with, like, just kind of these desires that God has kind of put in us that actually might be good, but we just have this such a long period and we're just trying to figure this out. Can you talk a little bit just about desire and what that looks like?
Yeah, I mean, would this be a good time for me to talk a little bit about from the biblical standpoint? You know, one of the things that I always talk about in sort of the beginning of a session is this whole biblical foundation of our dilemma as human beings. That usually if I were to say to you, what was the first human crisis? If many of you have, you know, grown up in church like I was, I would have said sin. You know, that's the big bad thing that we're all supposed to avoid. But really the first human crisis was Adam's dilemma of being alone. That during all of creation, as God's creating all the elements, he's blessing them by saying they're good. He's, you know, creating the sky and the water, saying they're good. And then he gets to Adam, and for the first time ever, God says, it's not good. And he isn't talking about our sinful behavior. He created something, God did, and then said, there's something not good about it. And he said, it's not good for Adam to be alone. And then as he's creating or showing the animals to Adam, saying, it's time for you to pick a partner now, Adam looks at all the animals and he names them, but he doesn't feel a connection to any of them. And then while he's sleeping, God takes one of his ribs, creates woman, brings woman in front of him. And I was going to read it, but I'll paraphrase. What he says is, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. There is a excitement about him, about her, you know, where he looks at her and then he names her. Her name is woman. Basically, because she is my partner. And so I think this is the origin of desire. I think God put it in us to recognize in each other. And I know this is sort of the first marriage verse, but I think this is just put in us across the board, that we would recognize people and we would say, I want to be a part of your life. I want to be involved with you, not even just in a sexual meaning. But I do know that that's also sexual, that he recognized in her someone who he was attracted to physically. And then it talks about how they were naked and they didn't feel ashamed. And that is true desire. And all the way to the point that they felt so vulnerable and free in that. And I think we were all given that ability. And then we kind of know that sin and the enemy just really distorted that whole beautiful natural thing that we can all feel.
And so this is natural and this is desire that God's put in us. It's like, how does that go from that to like lust and mm-hmm. kind of the perversion of the desires that we have?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's a big question, because it means different things for different people. I mean, the biggest answer I could give to that is, as believers, if we don't acknowledge that the enemy has taken this area and run away with it, then we're really doing ourselves a disservice. We have got to acknowledge that the enemy has totally distorted this. And I think by doing that, we can take ourselves off the hook a lot and not let that shame stick to us and condemn us so much, that we can look at that is always an area that the enemy will use to lie to us and to tempt us and to get us further away from God. It also leads to self-hate. It leads to, in couples, one of the negative effects I see is that it always, you know, if it's done prematurely, the biggest side effect I hear people saying is that it keeps them from really going to the more intimate places of being known, as far as talking about what I need from you and how can I give to you, how can I support you. Sex just really steals a deeper work that needs to happen in both people.
So you're saying there's some deeper, like, intimacy and things that that it should spring out of, but we end up just kind of focusing on kind of the, how do you say, like the peripheral, or just kind of our, mm-hmm. just trying to almost cheapen the desire that God has put in us. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, in a way, it's still really hard because, yeah. you know, especially for those that are still single and things, mm-hmm. like, yeah, it's just...
I don't think we validate, especially in our church communities, I don't think we validate how intense that waiting time is. And I know that a lot of people who are single feel very alone, very misunderstood, and they carry that shame that should be easy, that should be something that they should kind of wake up in the morning and be like, yay, I can't wait to just wait another day. It's just a not a realistic approach.
Yeah. Yeah, and so you're talking about intimacy, and I think what's interesting about this verse, if we could go back to verses 27, 28, it talks about kind of a rule, a law you have said. It was said, do not commit adultery. But I tell you, anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. I think what's interesting is what's unsaid. If that's one extreme, then maybe what God is saying is that this is what I don't want you to have, is to have desire and lust and all that. But what I want from you is just kind of a good desire and intimacy almost. Can you speak a little bit more on that?
Yeah, you know, again, I think we've been a little bit out of balance at times with how we see the law, and we see that the law, we hear a certain tone in God's voice that's usually like this, you know, don't do that. And there's so much mercy in the law, but it's not taught from a place of, you know, don't do that, because I love you so much, because I want to preserve your heart. You know, we don't hear that tone of God that's so loving. And at the same time, the law was meant to do what the laws do. They keep you in check. They keep you responsible. They keep you accountable. But the whole purpose of the law in the Old Testament was to pave the way for Jesus. That people would try and try and try to obey the law, and that God had to show us that we would never be able to do that without the power of Christ. And so seeing that this is all a part of a bigger picture, and for Jesus to then stand with a multitude of people and speak on this topic, he was right there saying, I'm the law. And speaking to them in a way that was saying, you're going to need me. You're going to need me if you ever think you're going to be able to pull this off. Sorry, that's my own little, that's not really the way it was worded, but.
And he kind of plays along with them because he's talking to people that are really used to the law.
Yes.
He says, well, let me give you an example. If you really want like a parameter, a law to kind of stay away from lustful desires, he says in verse 29, if your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than your whole body to be thrown into hell. And he says again, if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. So why does he say that? And it's kind of like almost like a satirical play on the law.
It is. I mean, growing up, when I heard that preached to me, I thought, what? What are we believing here? You know, that sounds so harsh. It is satirical. He doesn't literally mean go home and gouge your eye out. But what he's saying is, if you're going to go by the law only, this is what it's going to require of you. And yet, here I am saying that I am the law fulfilled. And again, reminding us of our deep need for him. You know, the law was never meant to heal. It doesn't heal. It just prevents us from doing something. And it prevents us from separation from God in the form of what he's referring to up here is hell. That just means separation from God. And I don't mean that in to minimize the power of that, but he doesn't want us to be separated from him. And so the law is there for a certain purpose, and yet Jesus is the one, and the Holy Spirit is there to heal and to actually get to the deeper pain or the deeper stuff that we carry that would make these things even an issue.
Yeah, and so it's not about like looking at the behavioral, because the law kind of looks at kind of that, but he really wants to get deeper into kind of our hearts. And I think you have a really great motto to kind of really help us understand, like, what is it in our hearts that Jesus is seeking after?
Yeah. And the reason I think this model is so good, especially in this area, is if we only had the law, then I think a lot of us would just fail a lot. And then where would we be? We'd probably feel really awful. And this is where I know Jesus has a deeper purpose for this, because he says there is no condemnation in Christ Jesus. So when we fail, it is never part of God's plan, Christ's plan, that we would go to condemning ourselves. So that makes me have to believe that if we're not condemning and he's not condemning, then what else does he want us to do with all that stuff? And so the picture I wanted to show y'all, can we look at that now? Is we call this the emotional cup. And you can see here can everybody see? Okay, it's a cup, basically. So When we are born, unless we've had some kind of birth trauma, we come into this world with a really open heart. And God made us that way. God made us to have an open heart with people for the purpose of relating, but he made it to be open so that we would always be able to seek him, to know him. So our hearts are open. Now, over time, when we go through positive experiences, we hold on to those. And, you know, it's our first birthday and everybody's celebrating us, and that feels so good to have everybody doting on us. When we turn 4 and 5, and when we are praised for things that we do, and when we're loved, when we fall down and someone hugs us, and we're comforted, all those things feel good and we hold on to those. But we also hold on to the painful things that happen. And you are made to do that. There is nothing, again, like I said, unless you have some kind of brain injury or something that prevents you from holding on to memories, you cannot help but store memories and emotions that go with those. And so these are some of the core emotions, kind of broken down into five categories. So we have hurt, which is anything from sadness to disappointment to grief and loss. We have anger, which is frustration, being irritable, all the way to rage. Fear is always going to be about the future, and it's based on hurts in the past. So fear, anxiety, worry. Guilt is the difference there between guilt and condemnation is guilt encompasses all the things that you do and you literally feel, yeah, I don't think God would be okay with that. You know, like, yeah, I'm agreeing with him, so to speak, that that's wrong. And then condemnation is all about lies. So things that we tell ourselves, I'm stupid, I'm worthless. We even do this about mistakes we've made where we think God should still be holding those against us. And so we kind of conduct ourselves in a way that says, yeah, I'm pretty sure he is. I'm pretty sure he's still mad at me about this, or he doesn't forgive this particular sin. And then you can see that the positive emotions are there, but what that picture is meant to show is that as those negative emotions start to fill us up, the positive emotions can actually get squeezed out. So if you think about if you enter into a new relationship, you're really excited about getting to know that person, and maybe in the back of your head, these lies or these fearful thinking patterns start to come up, like, oh, I don't know if it'll last. What if they find out about this? Or I don't know if they'll be here if I really tell them honestly who I am. So we can start to lose the peace that those positive emotions bring. And then the other thing that can happen is these symptoms result. And that's the next slide. And so these are just some different symptoms that I definitely hear a lot, probably, you know, daily in my practice. So feeling emotionally numb, where whether good things are happening, bad things are happening, it's just hard to access feeling at all. Sleeping disorders, eating disorders, irritability, hostility, rage. This one is, you know, when you find yourself having a big reaction to something that's really small, it's like that's a symptom of probably some deeper stuff that's going on. Depression, anxiety, we have controlling and obsessing physical complaints. This is when, you know, you can't, I know we put sleeping disorders up there, but even just headaches, things like that. And then you'll see the escape category. This encompasses a lot of different things, but we've become so creative about how we can escape our problems. And some of them even look good, you know? Like if you work a lot, people think, wow, you have such a good work ethic. If you like to have fun, people want to be around you, but it could be that you're escaping your pain. And I have affairs up there too, because, you know, one of the other powerful things that I love that y'all are talking about this passage is that we have really villainized infidelity and lust and affairs because they're awful, yes. But you can see up here, the way I'm showing it is it's really just another symptom. It's another symptom of there's deeper stuff going on. And when I'm meeting with a couple and infidelity has taken place, this is still where we start. You know, what led to that? What is the pain that's in that emotional cup?
And I think what's interesting is it seems like the top, what's the outflow, is more like behavioral, more of the symptoms of something that's more deeper. But why is it that we so often just, I mean, and necessary sometimes that we focus on, like, well, it's about depression, and how do, why is it that we just focus on the symptoms and so hard to kind of go deeper?
Again, this is a multi-level response, but one could be how we've been taught to view these things. You know, even just without a religious context, what did that look like in the families you all grew up in? You know, where was the focus? If you had one of these symptoms, and even for kids, this might look like acting out. Okay, say you were acting out in some way. Did the caregivers in your life focus on the behavior and say, you need to stop doing that? Or this is the boundary, this is your punishment? Or did they try to go deeper with you and say, yeah, what's that about? You know, why are you slamming doors? Are you mad about something? Did something hurt your feelings? So we learn from that. We really do. We, you know, in counseling, I don't ever want to be a part of digging up family stuff just so we can get mad about it and then blame it all on those people. But if we don't look at some of the issues of our childhood, we might be repeating things that if we really knew the impact and kind of spent time on them, we would really want to know what's back there. And we would want to see, how am I still doing that? One of the things that comes after that Genesis 2 account of Adam and Eve is, then it's time for them to leave father and mother. You know, it says, and this is why a man shall leave his father and mother, the two shall become one. Now what I really think that verse also means is that if we are acting out a way that we were taught to deal with this stuff that came from our family, we haven't left our father and mother, you know. And then the other implication that you talked about that I would see is, we have some religious baggage back there, that this is not new. I mean, Jesus was dealing with this with the Pharisees, where over and over they were trying to judge people on this kind of stuff and other things. And he was constantly having to remind them where their job ended. You know, your job is not about condemning that behavior. And so we haven't totally gotten that in religious, in our spiritual communities either. I think we're a little bit afraid of, well, if I care so much about that stuff, does that mean I'm condoning the behavior? And my flat out answer is not at all. It means that you're actually doing what Christ would want you to do, which is care for one another about those things.
And I think when I hear it, and I'm pretty sure a lot of people hear it, maybe the biggest question is like, how do you not just focus on that? Because we're just a very reactive type of people, and just like when things happen, we just want to try to fix it. I think when Jesus was saying, well, if you want to fix it, then gouge your eye out. So what he's still trying to say is like, no, you still need to get deeper. It's like, so how do we go from like, I think that's the question that a lot of us might be asking. It's like, well, how do we not focus on that and then go deeper?
I think it first has to begin in our heart, a belief that we have that says, yes, God cares about the symptoms. He doesn't want us to live life that way at all. But he cares also, and maybe even more so, about the pain in our life that brings those symptoms to even be an option. Changing the way we see symptoms, instead of like, we need to correct that, seeing that that is what that person has chosen to do to cope with all that pain. We don't want them to do that, especially not long term. But nonetheless, that is how they've decided, even subconsciously, to deal with their pain. And so it's really seeing it and not judging it, but it does have to begin in the heart. And then there are things we can do to actually address all of those emotions. So I can talk through that real quickly.
Yeah.
You're like, yes, please.
Please.
And Sam, you have this on some of your stuff, and I don't think it was put on this one, but we can you can always circulate that, or people can email me. But with each of these painful layers, there are many, many places in Scripture that actually address emotion, and for example, and what to do with it. So the one that I would probably want to emphasize the most today, because I could definitely spend a lot of time on all of them, but the one I would emphasize the most would be the hurt layer. And so if we choose to buy into, there's a lot of hurt under all of that stuff up there. We can find in Romans 12:15, where it says basically a command of how we're supposed to care for one another, and it's mourn with those who mourn, rejoice with those who rejoice. So if you think about, if you've gone through a happy time and other people around you were happy too, and how good that felt, that's like it just perpetuated all this joy. And think about on the other end of that, if you were going through a painful time and if people mourned with you, what happened to that emotion? Do you remember? You can even just yell it out. If someone got sad with you, what was the result of that? Yeah, you said it, comfort. We get this blessing, and Christ calls it a blessing, and y'all talked about that passage as well. Matthew 5:4. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. It is a promise that if we mourn together, we will get this blessing of comfort. And so we're never told to not feel that, ever. We're told to feel it. We're actually commanded, mourn. Mourn so that other people know about it. But what mourning looks like and what comfort looks like is literally that. It's just matching emotion with emotion, being with that person in their sadness. It is not a responsibility to fix it, because you can't. The only way you can actually fix it is by being with them. I will have entire sessions, which might be an hour or an hour and a half, where if someone's grieving, I cannot make them stop grieving. And so what we do is we're just sad, and I'm sad with them, and we talk about all the things about that that are so hurtful. And I can promise you, at the end of those sessions, I feel a blessing, but the report I get is, thank you. Thank you for removing my aloneness, just letting me feel that. And it's not a weight that we carry home. It's not a weight of, I didn't zap that and heal that in that person. That's not our responsibility to heal. That's the power and the work of the Holy Spirit. It's just being present with people as Christ was and letting them feel it.
Yeah, I just remember growing up, like, just being in a Christian culture where, like, they don't want me to feel hurt, so they created rules saying, like, well, don't date until college. And when I did date, they said, you need to break it up before you go, because in a way, they kind of want to help me, because they want to help me avoid pain, but at the same time, like, we're just trying to fix the actions and not really get into the heart of it.
Yeah, it's a lot of pain comes when people try to fix our symptoms without really understanding and caring for what it is that caused that. And that, we see that in our secular world, and we see that in the Christian community almost just as equally, that the hurt is just as real.
And so it's just the irony of this whole passage in Matthew 5 is, like, he talks about all these action-oriented, like, it seems like he's talking about symptoms like lust and divorce and anger, but he's really trying to get to the heart of who we are. And then again, the law is not about what we do, but it's about who we are. Well, let's continue on a little bit, get deeper now. In divorce, verse 31, now Jesus talks about divorce. It says, it has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality makes her the victim of adultery. And anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. It's not an easy topic to like just kind of come on stage to talk about. I think in a way I feel like I need to preface that, you know, that divorce is a real and a hard issue, and it's not something we could just gloss over and say just divorce is wrong. It is wrong, but at the same time there definitely, we want to be sensitive to situations where there, you know, either spousal abuse or things that might, although it's not ideal, but has to happen. But I think when Jesus was talking about this, it's not about like the unusual cases, but just kind of most of the time it can be prevented or avoided, right?
Yes, it can. Divorce is another symptom. You know, it's not on there, but I definitely would see it as another symptom of two people who are hurting. And, you know, another myth that I lived with when entering into marriage was that my emotional cup didn't really, you know, I hadn't dated Joshua that long, so there's not that much hurt between us. And so we are starting something brand new, and it's just only about us and what we bring into it. And the myth was that I had an emotional cup that was full of stuff that happened before Joshua, that what we quickly found, even in that first 3 to 6 months of marriage, was that those two cups were colliding, and he would trigger pain that I had before even knowing him, and I would trigger stuff in him not even knowing it. We talked about our families growing up, we talked about painful experiences, but I really had no idea the impact of that. And God's heart behind this, again, when I realized this, I thought, God, I don't really like that about you, because I wanted this to be a brand new relationship. I wanted to just be able to ditch all that stuff that I learned before. And what I've since realized that is so beautiful and difficult and powerful is that one of God's goals is that he would use the marriage relationship to help each other empty the stuff that's in that cup. And then I can say after 10 years of marriage that I understand Joshua more fully. When I hurt him, I understand the implications of that, not just from my own behavior, but from ways that that could have triggered and touched on pain in his past. And when I come to him and say, you know, when I didn't call you back, I can see how that could have really left you feeling rejected and even ignored. And I remember when you told me a story about a time that you came home and your parents were having church in your living room, and they didn't even see you walk in. And you walked all the way back to your bedroom, and nobody even saw you. And I remember you talking about how lonely you were. And as I'm telling him this, what am I doing? I am mourning with him, and I'm comforting him. And the blessing that we get to take part of in that is so rich that after that, he thinks, she knows me. Like, I am definitely not alone in this moment. I am not alone. And so it's a beautiful, beautiful gift. And I'm not saying we got there easily. It took us a journey to get there. But if we go straight to divorce, see, this is again God's heart that says, okay, yeah, I'll give you, there are things that you can do if you're in a situation. Like this passage, I think, is referring to sexual perversion in a form where the two people are saying, this is sort of a dark cycle that we cannot get out of unless some precautions take place. But with divorce, what it does is it ends something without healing ever happening. And we think divorce will heal because we're removing ourselves from this situation. But I'm sure you know people, and maybe you've gone through it yourself. Divorce does not heal that pain. You just leave that relationship with even more pain in your heart and in your cup.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Just kind of, there is a myth that maybe if I just remarry, that there, you know, it's a different person. This, now that maybe, you know, I've left this relationship, I understand myself better. I know what I don't want in a relationship, and it just feels natural or rational, logically, like, well, I've been through that, so now I know what I want better, and so you're seeking after better, and then you just kind of sometimes peripherally you hear like different people either in movies or TV shows or just in life of people's like, oh, now in my second marriage it feels so much better and I know myself better and everything's working out. Like, talk about that myth.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to deny that it can happen. I'm sure it can happen, but statistically it doesn't even support that myth. Statistics show that subsequent marriages after a divorce, the likelihood that divorce will happen again goes extremely up. So we have, I think, still a 50% ratio of divorce in America. And that is the same as for believers and non-believers, sadly. And so I think with second marriages, it goes up to 60 or 70%, third marriages. So it's a sign to me and to my colleagues, because we talk about this a lot, that isn't solving the problem. It's really, people are not leaving those relationships, going into new ones healthier and better at communication or better at resolving conflict or addressing the issues.
Yeah. Now, why is it that, like, in this day and age, we resort to divorce so easily? And especially in kind of in a religious circle, like, that, I mean, that statistic is still way, way high.
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely see a cultural swing when, you know, my grandparents' generation stayed together but weren't necessarily happy. And what that taught the next generation was that you are just supposed to ignore all of that. If you're not happy, too bad. Just stick with it. And so it still wasn't really addressing the deeper problem. It just looked good on the surface. And that doesn't hold up either. It doesn't hold up. And so I think the next generation and in our generation is much more about doing things that fulfill us, but the part that we suffer or are not as good at is the commitment part. Sounds a little bit controlled, it sounds a little bit parental, and it sounds religious, because again, if we're believers, we've possibly, very likely grown up with this authority from God, being from a God who doesn't know us and doesn't relate to us, but it's a God that just has rules that he expects us to follow. So we want to sort of rebel from that, and we kind of think, well, he doesn't understand anyway, so I'm just going to do it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And so I think, like how do we, like, you know, this is great, and then, but sometimes, you know, we walk out of like today's conversation, and then, you know, we get into our daily lives, and again, those feelings come back, and then, could you talk about maybe for singles and for couples, like, how do we start taking steps to, like, not focus our lives on just kind of the things that outflow the cup, but then really tangible steps of how do we focus on things that are in the cup?
Yeah. I think it has to start with your own journey. It has to start with where you are with this, what you're comfortable with. If this resonates with you and it, as I'm talking about it, is like stirring something in your heart, then one, I'm glad. And two, I'd say you're really ready then to embrace it in a way that says, like, I want to do this literally in my relationships. But it does have to begin with what has my experience been? Why do I do what I do? Why do I respond to people's hurt the way I respond? And asking the Holy Spirit to help you with those answers. If you're asking in more of a church community how we respond to it, I'd say seek out ways that fit who you all are, that I guess you would all sort of, you'd have a capacity or a place for those different groups, like for singles groups. I think there are so many ways that you can have a structure, not in a oppressive religious way, but a structure to talk about relational pain and to validate it, like I was saying, and to make your practice, how do we better come to understand what each of us is going through and how do we offer care? What does that look like and sound like? And then for married couples who are struggling with infidelity or divorce, again, having an attitude or a place in your heart that actually goes to compassion first, like, ah, that hurts me for them, and ministering to that pain first, and then doing what you can to help them get to the bottom of why they, you know, did what they did. But then if you can't, if that's sort of not who you are, then don't be afraid to send them on to do a deeper work and then create a community here where they can come back and they feel loved and welcomed and not judged for what they've been through.
A quick one would be, you know, maybe couples are hearing this like, all right, tonight I'm going to, right after this for lunch, I'm going to talk about like my deeper issues. Like, but sometimes maybe the other person's not ready, or mm-hmm. sometimes you feel like I want to bring it up, I just don't know how. Like, what would be a really, you know, tangible advice you would give couples to talk about this and not feel like, feel safe to talk
yeah.
about it?
Well, if your relationship doesn't feel safe to do that, you might need someone to help you with that. And I will be the first to say that's exactly how we started our journey, is that our relationship wasn't safe. And I don't mean we had violence. I just mean if I would have said to him, you know, I'm really hurting. I don't think we're doing this very well. What are you going to do to fix that? I mean, that would have been my tendency, would be to say, you need to correct something here. And then he would have felt judged and condemned. And so I mean, it wasn't safe for us to go there because we didn't know how, and we would have caused more pain to each other. So we needed to sit in front of someone who could help us with that. And I think we have a fear of counseling that it's this long, drawn-out process, because it used to be, and it wasn't even effective in some forms with that. But there are times that we go for checkups for just a couple hours. And I know when we started, we just sort of did what we could here and there. So that's kind of one option. If you have one takeaway, though, that you can all literally do, even if this was never done to you, it is let your heart buy into this message of comfort and hurt. And in your marriage, if you can make it your goal, whenever your partner brings up something painful or hurtful, join them in it. As much as your tendency, as it was mine, to fix and try to say, well, let's try to think of a better way to handle that next time. Doing what your heart was really made to do, it probably just hasn't been nurtured to do it very well. Just be with that person. I'm sad for you. I'm hurting for you. My heart aches for you. You will be totally amazed how quickly it transforms the way you communicate. Resist the urge to fix and just be. And you could form your whole community could be changed by just that one concept. Yeah. And I see it all the time.
Well, we're running out of time, but I think it's been really encouraging, and I think it's really helpful for our community here. And I think one thing to encourage everyone else here is, like, we're not just stopping with this. This is actually a first step that we're taking kind of as a church community to kind of take steps so that we're proactive in how we care for each other and stuff. So next slide, we have some tangible things that we're going to start doing here at Vox. We're going to be working on starting up a Vox relational care team. And what this will entail is just, if you're interested, come talk to me afterwards or send me an email. But we want like a group of just people within the community to kind of be that team, that first team, to kind of help bridge some of those conversations, individuals or couples that need care to be able to connect each other. So this team will actually go through some training. Sarah's been working with Mosaic, one of our friends, and they've been going through like 6 months of training, just how to contextualize a lot of this stuff so that, you know, resources that you can bring to help our church community do that. And so there's a More Than Counseling workshop that's coming up May 13th through 14th. And personally, I think I'll help lead the team, and I just want to get some the team together to really start really digging deep and training on kind of how to do that. You want to talk about that morning counseling workshop a little bit? What that looks like? Okay, so there's a flyer in the back on that table with that. A couple other things, next slide, is that Center for Relational Care is just something. Gideon and I had a chance to go visit the center, and also Sarah and kind of everyone that's there. The counselors are there, and it's just great people. And so just want to encourage you guys to, you know, to check it out. They have intensives for singles and married couples and families, and we won't read through that, but you can check it out at relationalcare.org. And then the last slide is if you had any questions today, and maybe if there's things that you want to struggle, that you're struggling with, or you have questions, you know, this is Sarah's email, and you can contact her. So, well, again, thank you for this time. Yeah, let's give her a hand.